Hey, you're listening to the Fanboy Strike Back Weekly Review Podcast, episode 41.
I'm David.
I'm Eric.
And we are the Fanboys of Strike Back. Every week we get together, we talk about the books that came out. One of us will pick what we thought was the best book of that week. And then we'll come here to the podcast, we'll talk about those best books. We're going to be talking about what Eric gave to me when we went to the Seattle Con, Batman Face to Face. I'm going to tell you what I thought about that. And about a week ago, a little movie called Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out, so we're also going to give you our review of that. But this is a comic book podcast. This was a big week for books, and spoiler warning, we are going to talk about everything in these books. Eric, in this huge week, what did you pick as the best book?
Well, I went with Final Crisis number one, and okay. I really enjoyed this. I know there's been some back and forth, especially David and I have already talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'll start with the art. I thought the art in this book was fantastic. There's a lot of little flourishes throughout the book. Even in the opening pages, you look at like the anthro scenes and just the shading and the color of the backgrounds, and usually something that I attribute to Ethan Van Sciver, but like the fire in the shot really looks like it's glowing on the page, and I really, really like that. There's other scenes, again, too, that there's just some nice contrasting, and the scenes with Jon Stewart where he's flying across the sky, especially with his ring that when it illuminates his costume, it almost looks like a toned-down Alex Ross. There's a few panels, and it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful, and I really love that red sky with the lightning flashing in the background, because we all know what that is now. That's Barry coming back, or the symbolism of Barry coming back, and I really, really enjoy that.
I can't say one bad thing about the art in this book, but the art was beautiful.
It was gorgeous. And so onto the story. It was a setup book, and I fully realize that. It's also a Grant Morrison setup book. And so a lot of this, some of this is going to seem weird. It's going to not make sense. I enjoyed starting with Anthro and ending at Commandy, just to give it like a bookend sense as well. We also got revelations on what happened to the new gods after they died. They basically were reincarnated into human form. And so we see, like, gradually where they're coming from now. And I really enjoyed that. And even Metron, who shows up at the beginning, he has a bit of a different look. But I'm really curious, because we know now what happened to the new, or we know the whole story of the new gods dying, but I like the fact that the characters aren't gone, that we're still able to use those. There were other scenes. Dan Turpin shows up, famous Kirby character. I basically know him from the Superman cartoon, but I'm interested to read more of him. We see that there's things going on and that the villains are gathering, and probably the biggest revelation in this one is the villains murdering Martian Manhunter. And there's been a lot of talk about that already of was it a throwaway, was it not? It did several things. First of all, it made Libra a viable threat, I thought. It's like, okay, well, I've been told this guy's a badass, but up until now I haven't witnessed him being a badass. And so now I'm really curious about who is Libra, what are his powers, you know, how is he so easily able to get Martian Manhunter to do this to him? I love that. We also see the Guardians starting to get involved, and that was great, too. It was just a lot about this book that it was a setup book, and it was very, very exciting to me. I was excited. I was a little confused, which is okay. Like I'm fully aware of, like, in the first chapter of a book, I want that confusion, because what that does is that enables me to be intrigued to read the rest of the story. It's like, I want to know how this turns out, and I'm sure by issue 7, I'll have a much better grasp on things. And I thought it was a good setup book for the rest of, for the big Final Crisis event.
Yeah. I didn't like this book so much. I don't I don't think the book was bad. This was exactly what I was worried about it being. Like, I did not like this because it was a Grant Morrison book. Like, I did not like this because it reminded me of, like, the first Crisis book, which I've kind of been talking about. Like, I have this feeling, like, there's all these characters in this book that I don't know. Like, Eric and I were talking about this earlier. And I think I have a very good grasp on DC knowledge. But I had absolutely no idea what was going on in this. And I feel like if this is Final Crisis, if this is, like, a crossover book, like, this should be a book that should be pretty straightforward. And I was so completely lost. Like, I mean, I have some kind of grasp of who Kamandi and Anthro are, and I know what's going on with the New Gods, but, like, all this stuff was just thrown in there for no reason. Like, all the stuff with the monitors, I had no idea what that all was about.
Well, you're not supposed to. That's the intrigue, is you want to find out what they're doing.
See, but I didn't feel that at all. I was just like, I mean, I think that there's two different ways you can set up a story. You can set up a story with questions, or, like, I feel like this is something I've been talking about for a long time. I feel like going into Final Crisis, I've had no idea what's going to happen. And even in this first issue, I still have no idea what's going to happen. And at this point, I don't really care anymore. And I'll be the first one to admit it's probably because I'm a little jaded by Countdown and all the stuff leading into Final Crisis. But, like, going into this book, I should have some idea what's going on. And I don't. Like, the only thing I know is going on is Barry Allen's coming back.
Yeah, but you also opted out of reading a lot of the Seth books, too. Like, you didn't read Countdown, which admittedly didn't help all that much, but you backed out of reading Justice League for the last couple issues and really, like, established who the Libra character is. It showed him uniting the villains again, things like that.
But I shouldn't have to read those should complement that, but I should be able to read Final Crisis on its own.
Okay, yeah. Okay. At the same time, if I didn't read New Avengers or Mighty Avengers and I stayed out of Marvel for a year and I read
Secret... But I haven't been at DC for a year. I've been reading. I just dropped these books, like, 2 months ago. I've been reading all these books for the past years.
Okay.
That's the whole thing. Like, I'm not saying Final Crisis is a bad book, by any means. I'm not saying it was poorly written. I'm not saying... Like I said, the art was beautiful and I think the story is fine. I just think it kind of encompasses the stuff that I just don't like about DC.
Okay, alright.
So, I don't know. Like, I will give it to, like, issue 3, and if I am not in it then I'm just gonna drop it.
See, I don't think this is all that... Personally, I don't think this is all that much different than Infinite Crisis, which you liked.
I loved Infinite Crisis.
But that was the same... That was big, cosmic-y action and stuff like that, and multiple, you know, the multiverse and multiple Earths and characters and things like that.
But it was so, like, easily established. Like, I knew the story, especially going in. And, like they're just throwing characters in that I don't even... Like, I mean... And this is just my personal thing. So it's like, all of a sudden, we're throwing in Dan Turpin, who we have... I mean, I haven't seen in the comics, like, ever. Like Eric said, I know him from the Superman cartoon. So I'm like, why is he...
He was around in the 90s in the Death of Superman stuff.
No, yeah, I mean, but I haven't read him, I haven't seen him in a comic for years, and that might just be because that's not the stuff that I'm reading, but it's just like, when Grant Morrison said that pretty much every single character in the DCU is going to be appearing in Final Crisis, that's one of those things that is going to appeal to a very big DC fanboy, but that's not going to appeal to me.
All right, that's fair.
And so, like, I'm not bashing on it by any means. I want to make that completely clear that I'm not bashing on it. I'm just saying, for my personal taste, I did not like it.
All right, what would have you picked?
I would have picked 1985 by Marvel, Mark Millar, and Tommy Lee Edwards as my book of the week. This is basically a quote-unquote period piece, and it's basically about a kid who's, I'm not sure how old he is, probably like 10, 12 in the year 1985. He's this kid who loves comics, who is reading comics, who is talking about how his parents got in a divorce, and he has to go see a shrink, and, like, his biggest escape is these characters in this world. And then all of a sudden, he starts to see the Marvel villains are entering the real world. Like, he sees a glimpse of the Vulture on the news, and then he goes to this old kind of haunted house, and he sees the Red Skull and Doctor Doom there. And that kind of where it left off, and I picked this up just because I'm a Marvel fanboy, and Jim Chung did the cover, and I had no idea what it was about, but I don't know. I mean, I guess Millar has been on this kind of kick with Kick-Ass and now this, that he wants to do kind of like these real-world stories, and basically about how, I don't know, like, what comics mean to people, especially young kids, and this just, it made me feel like I was 10 years old again. Like, he wrote this kid perfectly, and there's so many moments where, you know, the dad's kind of a deadbeat, and he has a stepdad who got a brand new Oldsmobile, you know, 1985, nice and sleek, and you're kind of looking at it, you're like, oh, that is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. He kind of rags on his friend because his friend is wearing a Masters of the Universe t-shirt and stuff like that. So I'm hoping there's going to be more of the period, you know, piece part of it. Like, I hope he talks more about the 80s and everything. But, like, I was blown away by, like, how I, like, bonded with this character instantly. Because, like, I was that kid. I mean, anyone who's listening to the podcast, and Eric and I mean, we were there when we were 10 years old, like, so into these characters, and it was like going through time and seeing yourself. So I would definitely check it out to anyone who, well, if you're listening to this comic podcast, just go try it. I don't know where it's going, but it was quite a treat to read.
Okay. The only thing, I didn't read it, but I would just say it'd be nice if, Miller finish one project before moving on to another, because Kick-Ass is
Kick-Ass comes out next week.
Does it?
So I think it's still on track. I think it might be a little bit late.
It's late,
but I mean, they're completely different. I mean, Kick-Ass is like really mature, really in your face. But this is like a Marvel title, so. Apparently, all the villains are going to come into the story, but we haven't really seen the heroes. It kind of ends with him seeing Dr. Doom, and then running, he runs into a tree, and he looks up, and it's not the tree, it's actually the Hulk, and it's the out-of-control Hulk, so we'll see where it goes from there. But it's cool, and Tommy Lee Edwards, I've never seen his art before, I have no idea what he's done, but it's good. It's kind of like an Alex Malee, very sketchy, kind of a Linnell Yu, very realistic looking, but it really fits the tone of the book, and yeah, I was impressed, because, I mean, I had no idea what the book was going to be, and it kind of blew me away.
Okay. Next book I want to talk about is Batman 677, continuing the Rest in Peace storyline. This book was freaking awesome.
What happened?
I am all in for this story now. Basically, it starts off with Bruce searching for the
Black. Is this part two or part, did I miss?
No, this is part two. The main portion of the story is all written by Grant Morrison through the Batman title. All the other stuff is kind of side books, is the way I understand it. Like, they'll deal with the RIP storyline, but they're not directly involved in it.
Okay, so what happened?
So he's hunting down, and basically a lot of this is just an extended thing of him in the cave talking to Jezebel Jett, because she knows the secret now. Something's going on with, and I don't think it's going to reckon, I think it's just someone playing mind tricks on him, but they're trying to insinuate that there might be a hidden past for Thomas Wayne that we're not aware of, and so we'll see how that relates to the Black Glove and what's happening to Bruce now, but we don't really know for sure yet. It sets it up to where it looks like someone close to Bruce is a traitor. Then, you know, offhand, I'm just thinking Jezebel Jett, because it's not going to be Tim, it's not going to be Alfred, and things like that. But they insinuate something. But what happens is, basically, a lot of it is Jezebel Jett going through the Batcave and kind of looking at everything, and, like, the computers, the costumes, and just kind of being like, are you... You're you know, are you really that sane? Like, you have to kind of take stock of what's going on in your life, and you're really kind of a, you know, there's something wrong with you, basically. She's just having a hard time accepting everything around her, and that's totally valid. That's fine. But it's just an interesting take, and the great thing is, while we're walking through, we also get to go through the cave with her, and Tony Daniel drawing everything in the cave is just, like, that blew me away almost more than the story did, because
You've become quite fond of Mr. Daniel, haven't you?
He owns Batman now, in that world. It is insane how this guy came out of left field, and I don't think I've seen anything that he's drawn before, but my God, it is just phenomenal. Even so, to where I'll forgive some background continuity glitches, but what happens is there's some kind of trigger where it sets Batman off Zurinar or something like that, but it basically starts, by the end of it, he's almost going into some kind of like hemorrhage or seizure or something like that. Something happens to him, and then we see that some people are surrounding the mansion and breaking in and attacking, and we end with Alfred getting beat up by people in the Black Glove.
Wait, so who set this trigger to set him off?
Not really sure. It looks like at first he's just looking at something on the computer, and then Jezebel's behind him and she's reading it, and all he can see is it just static on the screen, and she's like, there's pictures of graffiti. And she's like, it's just nonsense. It says this one word over and over again. And he's like, what does it say? It's Sir and R. And all of a sudden something happens to him, and he just kind of goes into this fit and gets taken out of commission. But it was really good. So yeah.
Do you really think with the Dark Knight coming out, this being a big year for Batman, that they are going to not make Bruce Wayne Batman? They cannot do that.
They're not gonna. I think he might get replaced for a little while, but I don't think he's definitely not gonna die.
But that's pretty ballsy to have the Dark Knight coming out and to have Bruce Wayne not be Batman.
Well, it's, of course it's not gonna last forever, but at the same time, Grant Morrison's going to keep writing this book for a while, so I'm assuming that he's going to have...
Oh, I thought this was going to be his last time.
No, he's on the title for a little while. I think after Final Crisis, he's only doing this book, though. Like, he's done with All-Star Superman and his other projects. From interviews, it sounds like he's just going to be on this book. So okay. I'm sure, like, he'll be able to dovetail this story into something else. But, I mean, there's always other books with Batman, with Bruce Wayne as Batman.
And Damian is going to be a part of the story, yes?
We don't know. He hasn't shown up yet. Or at least, well, he has, not in this book, but what we found out was he was training with Merlin, Green Arrow's, you know, villain, and he was doing archery, and he was with Talia, and they find out someone's going to attack Bruce, and he's like, let's go help my dad, or something like that, which... I don't know why Merlin was involved, and I hope he doesn't, like, figure out who... It seems odd they would compromise Bruce's identity with that, but...
Yeah.
I don't know. It's definitely interesting. So far, it's just gorgeous. It is an absolutely beautiful book, and there's enough little dark twists and turns. It feels very much like a 90s... It's very psychological. And that was how Batman was in the early... I'd probably say early 90s, like 91, 92... And it feels just like it's out of that era, and that's my favorite Batman era. So this is candy for me.
Okay, fair enough. Giant Size Astonishing X-Men number 1 came out. So this would be the end of Whedon and Cassidy's run. 25 issues in about 4 years, so maybe 5, probably 4.
So sad I'm reading this in trade.
And, okay, so you have to let me know exactly how much of this I can spoil for you.
Just go ahead, because I've heard on other podcasts what goes on.
First thing I have to say is there are maybe 2 comics that I have come extremely close to crying in. The first one was the last issue of Fallen Sun, where all the people started to stand up at the funeral for Cap. And the second would be this issue, both which were drawn by John Cassaday. And I am going to tell you right now, I almost lost it at the very end of this issue. Like, I was just... Oh, gosh. It was rough, Eric.
Hey, girl.
Hey, easy. You know, it kind of got ruined in Uncanny X-Men that Kitty Pryde was going to be the one that was not going to come back from the break world. And basically what you see is that we were kind of left off with her phased into a bullet, which is headed towards Earth. And it's made of this metal that it's really hard for her to phase through. And all this stuff's going on. You know, Colossus is fighting for the break world. Cyclops and Emma are trying to fly this ship to meet up and try to somehow get Kitty out of this bullet. All the heroes are gathered up on the Earth with the Fantastic Four, the Avengers, Spider-Man. They know this bullet is coming and they're trying to figure out some way. And nothing works, basically. And we're getting to the very end and this bullet's about to hit Earth. And Kitty somehow phases the entire bullet, and the bullet actually goes through the Earth, and it is one of the most breathtaking shots I have ever seen in my entire life. Like, Cassaday it's this huge page, this huge spread of Manhattan, and a bullet is just completely being phased through it, and then it comes out the other side in China, and it's not so much of like the bullet in the Earth, but it's just like in between there's little cuts of character faces, and you see Kitty, and like she's sweating and she's hurting, and like you feel it, like you feel how exasperated she is and how tired she is, and you see Scott and Emma looking on, and Cassaday has the best facial expressions I've ever seen. Like, whether the characters are shocked or angry or in love, or like, you know exactly what these characters are feeling. Like, I would love to see a Cassaday book with no art, because he could pull it off, or with no words, because he could pull it off just as well. And there's this one page where you see Kitty just crying and giving everything that she can, and you see Peter, and there's kind of a silhouette in his head. And he's just sitting there, and he's just smiling, because he knows what she's doing, and he's so proud of her, and he loves her. And I almost lost it, right? I totally just almost lost it. And at the very end, you know, they're just talking about the fact that they got through it. Scott has to put back on the visor. You know, he talks about how it was a gift from Emma, but, you know, he can't contain it anymore. And Peter just talks about, you know, there's good things in your life, but all of a sudden they're just gone. And you see that the bullet is still traveling through space, and Kitty is basically phased to it on a molecular level. So she's not dead, but they don't know where she is. This is definitely going to go down as one of the best X-Men stories, one of the best comic book stories ever. I was blown away. I don't even know what else to say.
Is it the best X-Men story you've ever read?
It's not the best. It's up there. You know, it's hard to say it's the best, just because a lot of what, if you're like a diehard X-Men fan, which I consider myself to be, a lot of what that means is the continuity. And this was completely out of continuity, so I think that that's why maybe it's not my favorite. But this is one of the best things I've ever read. I mean, I'm talking like, this is one of the best stories I've ever seen. I'm talking like movies, comics, books. I was just fully enveloped in this whole story. And it's taken 4 years, and it was only 25 issues, but I would not have had it any other way. It was pretty much perfect. Yeah. And I am very sad that they're going to continue on with Astonishing. I think they should just stop it right here. There's no reason to keep doing it, but this is one of those books that just, like, makes me happy. I'm a comic fan, and it's just one of those books where, like, I feel like people are missing out, And this would be one of the first things that I would give to someone to get in the comics, because this whole thing was amazing. It just absolutely amazing.
Alright.
So, like, I mean, you might not be happy that you're reading it in trade, but it almost might work out better for you, too, because you're going to get all of it, you know, kind of at once, while I've been doing it, like, you know, once every 4 months.
Yeah, well, the trades aren't coming out quick either, though, but...
That's true.
Yeah, it's good. Another one I want to talk about is Ultimate Spider-Man number 122. I really like this story. I love it when Spider-Man villains find out, like, he's really just a kid. I love that. Because this one, the Shocker basically knocks him out and takes him back to, like, a warehouse or something like that and ties him up, pulls off his mask, and he's just, like, for a page, he's just like, a kid? It's a kid? A kid? And it was good, but also it got pretty brutal because he's just hanging there, and the Shocker just keeps kind of torturing him almost to try and get information out of him. And of course, it's not happening. But I don't know. After a while, it's like, kind of, you know, he can't keep taking much more of this. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, what happens is we get nice little cuts of Mary Jane. She was there when Peter was abducted, and so she's wondering, you know, what do I do? What do I do? She ends up calling Kitty because Kitty's the only one she can think to help. And so it's the police are out there, and they say, you know, if anyone has any information, she's like, well, you know, should I go to the cops? If I do, would that compromise his identity? And in the meantime, they decide, well, yeah, we should. And they work out kind of a deal. But it was, the whole in-between is we kind of get more in-depth with the Shocker. We find out, you know, I mean, he's still an asshole, but we find out more motivation of what made him that way. And by no means do they make him sympathetic, but at the same time, right. It was also just some character development on his part. But I also really like Peter, how, you know, for most of the time, he's been joking and kind of demeaning the villain with his quips and things like that. But at the same time, after a while, he's just like, well, you know, what happened to you? What did you do? Or what, you know, what did they do to you? And, you know, you see a real compassionate side to him, too. Like, maybe he can help.
Yeah, Bendis actually, I mean, there's two things that have been... Basically, the Shocker has been a running joke in Ultimate Spider-Man since issue number one. Basically, every couple of issues, he's robbing a bank in one scene, and Peter just takes him out. And it's happened for the whole series, and they kind of talk about it. Because the Shocker's like, you know, every time I get out of prison and I try something, you're there to screw it up. So it's cool, because he's always just been a running joke. The second thing is that the Roxxon Corporation... Bendis has been playing this up for a while now, and it's coming into full effect with this, and the Shocker, when he was talking about, you know, why he is the way he is, you know, the corporation has a lot to do with that. He said that he started working for them, and all of a sudden things didn't go the way he planned, and it should be interesting, because they are in the Marvel Universe. They haven't really been in the Marvel Universe for a while, so it should be interesting to see what Bendis's take was. But I love issues, yeah, like, just like you said, I love issues like this. This was just a standalone story, and it was very character-driven, and like Peter said, like, he was, you know, he gave the Shocker some crap, but then, you know, he realized, like, there was something really wrong with this guy, and he did become, you know, quite sympathetic. Like we said before, Kitty Pryde being in this book is just one of the best dynamics. I love how Mary Jane's talking to Kitty, and Kitty's like, well, let's just call Johnny Storm. And Mary Jane's like, oh, I should have thought about that. And I just love the interaction between those two characters. And
there was a really nice scene where at the end, Peter gets loose and he starts, he really goes after the Shocker with some, you know, real anger, because the Shocker was going to kill him. And he's mm-hmm. just kind of beating the snot. And Kitty gets there in time to kind of stop him. She's like, don't do that. And he's like, he's in pretty bad shape at this point, and, you know, how did you find me? And she's like, Mary Jane helped me find you, and she's like, Kitty admitted that Mary Jane's a good girlfriend. Peter was like, so are you. And I really like that.
Yeah.
That there's still a little something there, but it shows you just kind of the close nature of friendship that they've developed. And I really like all of his friends in this book, and I know we just came out the Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends story, but, like, the relationships that he's developed with Iceman and the Human Torch and Kitty Pryde, I really enjoy the dynamic between all of those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, not that, you know, I like that they're all kind of the same age, but they're all on separate teams. They're all spread out in various corners of the Ultimate Marvel Universe, but at the same time,
like the Ultimate Teen Titans.
Exactly. And it's really, really good. So, yeah, this was fun. And I say that about every issue, and I'm really excited about the Venom storyline coming up in the next one.
Yeah, and the symbiont's coming back. Should be interesting. We haven't seen that in quite a while. The last book I wanted to talk about really quick was X-Force number 4. I've talked about X-Force and how it's kind of bringing back old villains, and it's focusing more on the human villains that have a problem with mutants, which is, I kind of dug. I thought it was a pretty original idea. Yeah, this issue got really weird. Basically, with this issue, Wolfsbane, Rain Sinclair, who's a member of X-Factor, now a member of X-Force, one of the purifiers gave her a dose of... basically gave her an overdose of heroin. So they took her to Angel's mansion to have Elixir kind of heal her. And he heals her, and she wakes up and she's fine, but all of a sudden she sees Angel, and she goes crazy. And she basically rips Elixir's chest apart, and she starts going to town on Angel. And you're not sure exactly, and I haven't been a huge fan of the art, Clayton Crane, because it's very pretty, it's very, like, hyper kind of realistic, and the colors are kind of too much for me, but the way that the scene with Rain and Angel is portrayed is like you don't exactly see what she's doing, but you just see that there's blood everywhere, and it was actually really graphic. Like I kind of like, you know, winced, but ultimately you see that she is cutting off his wings, and she succeeds. She takes the wings completely off.
Hasn't he lost his wings before?
He's lost his wings before, that's when he became Archangel, and then his original wings grew back, and that's when his techno-organic wings were gone. Now, that's playing into everything. You find out that she's taking these wings to the head of the Purifiers and to Bastion, and this kind of plays into a story that was in New X-Men, because a kid named Icarus, who was named Josh Guthrie, which is Cannonball's brother, he had wings also. And one of the Purifiers killed him and cut off his wings. And they're talking about how they have a new set of wings, and they take Angel's wings to a scientist, and they discover that while his wings look normal, they're still techno-organic. And they basically use the cells of his wings to give techno-organic wings to all these other people. So they kind of have a soldiers, are an army of archangels, so to speak. It was really weird. I kind of liked it just because of the whole continuity and, you know, kind of seeing where things go, because they never really explained how Angel's wings grew back, and you kind of figured out that they never really grew back. They were just different. The shocking, and I'm not sure how to think about it, end of this book is that Angel turns back into Archangel. His skin turns blue, he regrows his metal wings, and he looks vicious, and he doesn't look in control, and he looks like he is not going to be an ally of X-Force. So I was really surprised by that, because if Angel is going to turn back into Archangel, I did not expect that to happen in X-Force. I feel like that should have happened in like an actual X-Men book.
It's probably temporary.
Yeah, and it might be temporary, but I don't. But I mean, his wings were cut off. Well, so I don't know.
They gave him wings back before. I doubt this is going to carry on to the other books. This is probably just a, you know, two or three issues, they'll probably give him back and be normal.
But, you know, honestly, I hope that he has his metal wings back. I hope that he is Archangel, because that was always actually, I think, a very good run for the character, because as much as I love Angel, you know, Angel's kind of been one of my favorite X-Men, he's not much of a threat, you know? He can fly, that doesn't really help that much. And when he became Archangel, it became, like, there was so much more depth to the character. You know, he had to deal with all the stuff that had happened to him, and then he had, you know, he had more of a physical threat with his wings. And I honestly hope that he goes back to being Archangel, because Angel's really been lost in the X-Men books for, like, going on 10 years, probably. And so it'd be nice to see him back. But it was weird, but decent. Like, I still thought it was a pretty good story.
Okay, well, that does it for us this week for comic reviews. Like David said, we both went and saw the Indiana Jones Kingdom of the Crystal Skull movie, and we haven't talked about it yet with each other, so I'm really interested to hear what David has to say. So, what did you think?
Well, you're the big Indiana Jones fan, so what did you think?
Okay, well, Indiana Jones, growing up, was up there with Star Wars for me as far as, like, movie trilogy. Well, Star Wars Back to the Future for Batman and Indiana Jones for, like, you know, what I watched as a kid.
Batman was not a trilogy. The best Batman movie was Batman and Robin.
Not trilogies, but just what I was obsessed with. Characters I was obsessed with. But, I mean, like, I had little fedoras and makeshift, you know, jackets and things like that, and, you know, I was running around the yard whipping things with, you know, string. But,
there you go.
I was going through it, and it had a lot of really nice moments, and it does echo the previous movies a lot. And then there's some twists and turns in the movie later on in it, and, you know, spoilers, we're going to talk about what happens. But basically what happens is they take the idea that's been a conspiracy theory out there. It's kind of a far-out conspiracy theory, but it's existed for years now that, you know, Mayan technology and things like that was, you know, a quote-unquote gift or brought to humans by extraterrestrial species. And, you know, that theory is out there. It's, you know, kind of one of the lunar ideas out there. But they take that and they kind of put more of a context on it. And it's not bad. You know, you see the skull and you see that Indiana Jones in the 40s, that the government brought him out as part of the Roswell crash, and we see, you know, we revisit the warehouse where the Ark of the Covenant is and where supposedly America hides all their secrets, which I thought that was a really interesting idea, just this warehouse of every top secret item and thing. Like, I was like, that's pretty effing cool. But at the end, we do come face-to-face with an alien. Very, very close encounters of the third kind, and I was sitting there for a second, and I was like, you know, does this belong in an Indiana Jones movie? Is this going to be the point where I'm like, nope, I'm not buying it? And I just decided to go with it, because I thought to myself, you know, as far out as this is, Indiana Jones has always been about archaeology and discovering things, but at the same time, it's always been a hyper-archaeology. Like, the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy Grail are, you know, things that you've read about, you know, at Sunday school and things like that, and then there's the Sean Carr stones. Each of these items, Spielberg and Lucas gave a supernatural tinge to. Like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indy faces ghosts at the end and people's face melting off. Temple of Doom, we have people ripping hearts out and people living after that. And I think Last Crusade toned that down a bit. But, I mean, there's always been a very big emphasis on the unknown. It's not indie and archaeology, realistic archaeology, it's indie and the unknown. And I thought this was just the next logical extension of that unknown. Like, it's, you know, ghosts and religion and voodoo and, you know, shit, aliens, why not? And you know, it's
let's
also
throw some aliens in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it fit. I thought the way they did it in the storyline worked. There's a few scenes that I was like, I'm not the biggest fan of that, but I thought the movie was good. I was vastly entertained. I really liked Shia LaBeouf, or LaBeouf, whatever his last name is, as Indy's son. I thought that was done really well. The Bring Back Marianne was fantastic. There's just some scenes where, even though they're older, there's still that spark between them, and where she just gets that, you know, grin when Indy compliments her. And I like that dynamic between them where they argue and they make up and they argue and they make up. At the same time, the movie was very emphasized on Indy's old. He's old now. And there's no getting around it, but at the same time, I don't know.
Harrison Ford, he pulled it off, though.
Yeah, he did. And I gotta say, I don't know if it's the sound effect or what, but no one throws a punch like Harrison Ford. Just that sound. It's like chopping lettuce. It's just BAM! It crunches. It's, that was fun. I guess the biggest thing I could say about this was it was like going back and seeing old family again. And it was really nice, for me to go back and revisit that character of my youth. And, this is most likely his last adventure. It's nice to go back and revisit that. It was like going home again. And I really enjoyed it. I was entertained. I had a great time. It made me... I think a lot of these movies, Star Wars prequels included, draw a lot of flack because people look at them and they're like, well, it wasn't as good as the one that came out when I was 10 years old. Why doesn't that make me feel like I'm 10 years old again? And blah, blah, blah. This one... It did make me feel like I was 10 years old. As soon as that fanfare starts up, I'm really, I'm all in. And I like that they tied in all the movies echoed. I thought this one, at first I was like, well, it echoes the previous movies a lot, but all of them echoed each other. I mean, they all have the plane ride that goes across the map, and they all have certain scenes like Indy teaching in the classroom and Indy doing this and this escape, in the middle of the movie. There's beats... that it wasn't just this one following the other ones. Each of those movies did. And so I thought, well, this one falls right in line with the rest of them. And I liked it. I thought it was fun. I thought it was a worthy inclusion in the series. I put it up there probably with Temple of Doom. It's not my favorite, but it was good. And for the most part, I was happy with it.
I did not like this movie.
Okay.
I feel exactly like you mentioned, except for when you get to the part where there's aliens. I was like, okay, I officially don't like this movie now.
You can either go with it. I think that's the dividing line, though. Is as soon as they show up, it's like, okay, you either have to go with it or not.
I was just, I think you're correct. I think you have to kind of go with it or you don't. I think my whole thing was, I did not think there was any way there was going to be aliens. They had set it up the whole time, and I was like, okay, there's no way they're actually going to be aliens, because they're saying, they're aliens, And so I kept on waiting, I was like, okay, now I know that it's not aliens, I really want to know what this crystal skull is all about, and I know it's not going to be aliens, so it's going to have something to do with, archaeology. I mean, I know it's going to be mythical, but it's not going to be aliens. And then when they're like, it's aliens, I was like... But you've been saying that, so it can't be aliens. And I was just like, that doesn't make any sense to me. So, and I think that was just because of my how I got kind of wrapped up into it. And I was so sure that it wasn't gonna be aliens, but by the time aliens showed up, I was just like, oh well, I don't like this, And I think I'm not a huge fan of Indiana Jones. I think the only one I can really say that I ever really loved was The Last Crusade. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not coming in with all these expectations and everything. And I thought, for the up until the very end of the movie, I thought it was really fun. I just had a nice time. And I don't think it was a bad movie, just because of the ending. I thought it got a little bit far-fetched. Not only the fact that there was aliens, but kind of how... they were dealt with. When I saw the flying saucer, I was just like, okay, this is too much for me in an Indiana Jones movie. There can be aliens, but this is worlds are colliding here.
Yeah, I cringed a little bit at that scene too, and that was you could tell Lucas was pushing it, make it a 50s B movie. And, and I'm just like, okay.
That's what Lucas has been talking about. That's how he wants Indiana Jones to be in.
Well, because this one's set in the 50s now as opposed to the 30s, but I don't think you can change it.
That's the neck talking.
Yeah, it is. It's the neck. But at the same time, I probably would have been happier had, because in the initial part of the movie we see, we're in the warehouse and we see the Russians uncover, a body that was found at Roswell, and it's just a dead, frozen body, and we see, an alien hand. I would have been fine if that was all the alien we saw.
Yeah, that would have been good.
At the end, when they come back, and the way they came back was a little odd, and then, you know, you're almost like, well, what the hell is happening here?
And it was just kind of too convenient, because I forgot the actor. He's a really great actor, but the guy who was crazy for the whole film.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when they're talking about the aliens, and he's all of a sudden, oh, and he gets his sanity back, and he's like, oh, they're not from another world, they're just from another dimension that is on, the side of ours, and the space shuttle takes off, they leave, and that's it. And you're just like, yeah. What happened?
Well, the thing is, I can definitely see your point that there was absolutely no twist in the storyline at all. I think the point, Mutt being Indiana Jones' son was supposed to be the twist, but that was the worst-kept secret in Hollywood.
Right, so, right. I think we all saw that going.
But you saw it, you did see everything this coming from a mile away, and there was no twist in the plot, which, you know, it...
Which is fine, it just wasn't what I was expecting.
Yeah, well, it could have been more clever, but it wasn't, and I think that's what puts it a step. I think there's a lot of jokes where in Last Crusade and Raiders, there were jokes and there was humor, but it wasn't continually hitting on a certain theme. And in this one, it was just like, Indy's old, Indy's old, Indy's old, Indy's old, and it's just, okay, I get it. But, all said and done, and, you know, I could have gone through this and I could have let all that ruin it for me, but being, like, close to the character, like I said, I love Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. You know, I minored in archaeology, I've done some work in it, I really enjoyed, I enjoyed that aspect. And so, I could have sat there and been like, this ruins it, but I was just like, no, you know, don't think about it too hard, most of all, it's a summer movie, and it's really hard to put that up against, you know, something that I cherish so much from my childhood. I just said, no, I'm going to put that in my head, I'm going to go with it and just have a good time with it. And there were moments, like I said, like the vine swinging with the monkeys.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
we'll forget about that. But at the same, and maybe I'm being too forgiving, but at the same time, it's just like...
No, I don't think so, because I think if I had the same love for the character that you do, I love episode one. I see it for all the faults that it have, but I still love it, you know, because I am a huge fan of Star Wars. You know, I'm so detached from Indiana Jones that I can just be like, I didn't really need to see this, but I can definitely see that if you're a big fan that you want, yeah, you're going to look for it and just be like, okay, I can handle it.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I'll give you that.
Okay, yeah.
So overall, as a summer movie, I think it's enjoyable as the legacy of Indiana Jones. I think you would leave it at the third one.
It's probably coming in at a fourth place level. That's, you know, if we are ranking it, if it has
I think Last Crusade is the best.
Oh, yeah, I do too, and then I think Raiders is after that and Temple of Doom, but...
See, I like Temple of Doom. No one really likes Temple of Doom.
I like Temple. Temple of Doom was my favorite growing up until... And even...
That's just because you got to watch someone's heart get ripped out as a kid. It was awesome.
Freaking awesome. But I remember, I went to go see Last Crusade in the theater, and I remember going to see it, and I was like, well, we're a short round. But, and even growing up, I loved... Temple of Doom was my favorite, and then when I got older and could appreciate more of the themes that was happening in the other movies, I think Last Crusade... just hit me more emotionally and with the humor and everything. But as far as which critically, you know, how they were made and the storylines and what happens in each story, I think this is probably fourth place. And, you know, but that doesn't, and that's not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that I love all of them. So, I'll buy it. I'll put it on the shelf with my other, you know, Indiana Jones DVDs. It was good. Like I said, it was going home again, and it was like going back to see old family, and it was great. As soon as that, you know, dun, 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 and I was singing it all weekend. And the people I was out of town on vacation, and we went to see this the first weekend, and I couldn't get it out of my head, and then they started singing it, and it got in their head. It was like the theme song of the weekend.
All right, very good. Okay, so. We went to the Seattle Comic Con, and then we made a pact that we're going to buy a trade that the other has to read that they normally wouldn't pick up, You guys heard Eric talk about Young Avengers, which I got for him. He picked up Face to Face, the first story of Batman being back after the 1 year later, Mumbo Jumbo, The Return of Two-Face. And I read it. I have mixed feelings about it.
Okay.
I have discovered that I do not like Batman or Bruce Wayne in his own book. I am a huge fan of Batman on a team, but I don't think I'll ever like a Batman solo book. But I love the characters in the Batman universe. So, with this story, this is a story of basically how Bruce Wayne left for 1 year to go to Nanda Parbat, which we'll never figure out what happened there. He went to a cave and yelled for a while, and then he got better. And Harvey Dent is his replacement for guarding Gotham City. When Bruce comes back, all of a sudden it looks like Two-Face or Harvey is killing people. And although Harvey wasn't doing it, he kind of gets upset that Bruce doesn't believe him, and he turns back into Two-Face. I just kind of thought that, like, I loved the Harvey part of it. I really liked the Tim part of it, because I read some of these issues when they came out. You know, Bruce, the whole time, Bruce is talking about all these plans that he has for Tim and Tim's future and what's it going to be. And it makes you feel like, you know, is Tim going to be Robin? Is something going to go on? And at the very end of the book, you find out that Bruce adopts Tim, which is really, I thought that was a great part of the story. I thought that the Harvey Dent turning into Two-Face was a little bit too convenient. I thought it was a little bit forced, although I loved seeing it, and it was so messed up when he just takes the acid and pours it on himself.
Yeah.
And then that's not good enough, so he takes a scalpel to kind of do the fine touches. That just made me, I can't even think about it.
That's gruesome.
The thing about that, and this is my problem, is that throughout reading this whole story, I wanted to read the story of Harvey Dent and Gotham City alone for a year. Like, that's the story I wanted to read, and that's all I could think about while I was reading this story.
Yeah, unfortunately that was never written.
And I still wish they would do that in, like, a mini or something, but
yeah, no, it'd be great.
But yeah, I'm not a big fan of Batman. I just kind of find him whiny, but I love, like, the Batman universe. I'm not sure if that makes any sense.
No, I can understand that. The supporting cast, I always think the supporting cast is actually, unless Batman is in the hands of a really talented writer, which I like James Robinson a lot, but
yeah, I thought the writing was good. I thought the art was great.
I think the surrounding
and it was cool to see him coming back, and when he dealt with Poison Ivy, he was the kinder, gentler Batman, because the one thing that we had learned from Infinite Crisis and everything is that Bruce had gone too far. And the whole thing about him being gone for a year is that he kind of needed to tone it down.
Yeah. There were a lot of scenes that I liked, especially the Robin stuff that you mentioned I really enjoyed, but like the first time the bat signal illuminates the Gotham sky after a year, and people are looking out their windows, and they're like, you know, they feel safe that it's back and things like that. I really enjoyed that moment.
I think what sticks out to me as probably the thing that I'll remember the most, shockingly, is the conversation that Bruce has with Bullock, where he's talking to Bullock, and he's like, you know, you're a dirty cop, you've done some messed up things, I don't trust you. And then Bullock's kind of like, well, you've been gone for a year, obviously something happened to you. And Bruce kind of stops, and he's like, all right, you know, we start from here, everything that's happened in the past is erased. And you know, he kind of, Bullock basically shuts him up and says, you know, haven't you ever done anything wrong? And I thought that was like a real moment. Like, that didn't seem like, that was like just two people talking. And like, it was just like,
yeah,
so well voiced. Another thing I wanted to discuss is that I finally picked up and I read The Killing Joke.
Oh.
I've never been a huge Joker fan. I loved, like, seeing his origin story.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. You know, the whole thing about the Joker, and it was heartbreaking because like he has this wife and a daughter on the way, and then all of a sudden she dies, and I think it's one of the best things I've ever seen. Like the Joker is just saying, "I'm insane," and you know, one bad day, or you know, one day that just brings the world down around you. That's what it can take to make a normal man sane. And that's basically what he tries to do with Gordon.
How he's trying to justify that he's not that different from everyone else. It's just it
the circumstances.
Just, yeah, one bad day to go from you know everyone else to him, and that's the only thing that separates him. Although,
I thought it was so like I mean it was pretty in your face. Obviously, with everything he opens the door and just shoots Barbara straight up, and I was just like, oh. And then, you know, he takes pictures, and it's... I thought it was a little convenient that after everything he does to Gordon, that Gordon wasn't more upset. Gordon's just like, okay, I want him taken down by the book. Like, I can understand him seeing that, but it seemed like he didn't even struggle with the decision. But also, you have to explain to me what happens at the end, because I didn't understand what that was at all.
Well, that's... The end leaves off on kind of the Joker telling Batman a joke. And then they both kind of stand there, and then it looks like Batman lunges at him and grabs him, and then the cops show up and it pans to their feet. You don't really know what happens. That's a great mystery of the story. It's just assumed that the cops show up and they take him back to the asylum, and that's basically it. But there's something going on there, and it's like Ryan Ballin's joke that only he knows, and so it's kind of the ending is purposely left ambiguous, and you just assume that he's taken back to Arkham, and then. A death in the family followed this by only a couple months, and basically Joker is back in the asylum and he escapes, and they mention it that like he needs to get out of town because of the heat would be on because of what he just did to the commissioner's daughter.
Okay.
And so that led to him getting out of town and going to find Jason's mother and everything that resulted from that. But yeah, this story, while it shows a very, very twisted and dark deed done by the Joker. It also shows a very vulnerable side of him.
Because I've never seen anything about the Joker's origin. I know that this story has been out there, and I never really knew that it actually showed this much of his origin. But like I felt really sympathetic for him. Like, because if you're in those shoes, you're just like, oh, that obviously you're not going to react the way he did. But it was just heartbreaking seeing that because, like, he was really trying to do the right thing and he was worried about, like, how he was going to provide for his wife and this new baby. And then he just loses it.
Yeah, and there's some artwork in this book that terrifies me. Like, I think Brian Bolland, you know, he owns the Joker, and it's just terrifying artwork from the first time when he sees himself in the puddle to there's another shot near the end where Batman punches him through a window and he turns around on his knees and he's got a gun in his hand. And there's something about his eyes that terrifies me. And it's just this look in his eyes. And we found out the gun's empty and this is a great moment that I love. And he's just like, oh, God damn it. You know, and at this point he realizes he's lost. He didn't, you know, Gordon was fine. He didn't accomplish what he wanted to. And he's just like, you know, beat the crap out of me. You know, you do what you're going to do. It doesn't make a difference. You know, it's done. And at that time, you know, that's when Batman says, no, you know, I'm doing this one by the book because that's the way Gordon wants it. But, you know, it shows that, like, Joker's not as crazy as he wants everyone to think he is.
Yeah, it was just kind of his excuse.
Yeah, and so I really... Yeah, and of course, this book has been out there for years. I've read it a long time ago, but I'm really glad that you picked it up, and I'm glad, and I'm also really surprised that you liked it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was pretty good. Like, I thought that there were some convenient parts, but overall, I thought it was really well done. I was on a Batman trifecta. I bought the Long Halloween, the Absolute Edition. I read the Long Halloween before. I thought it was pretty good. I didn't think it was actually, you know, all that great. Rereading it, especially in Absolute form, this is... It is by far my favorite Batman story.
Really?
It's amazing. And I'm not sure if it's like I have a whole new appreciation for Tim Sale and Jeff Loeb lately, but this is amazing stuff. Like, I'm not a big fan of crime books, and I'm not a big fan of dark books, but, like, you know, going into the mob, and the thing about this is that this Batman is not in this book a lot. I mean, this is, like, I like it because it's, like, a trifecta. Like, this is it's a Bruce Wayne Batman story. It's mostly a Harvey Dent story, but there's a lot of Gordon in there, and it's a lot of them, you know, working together. They basically set it up where it's, like, for Gotham City to be where they want to be, these three men have to work together. You know, and it's kind of like, you know, they hate the fact that they need Batman, but they need him. And they have to have Harvey there as the DA, and Gordon has to, like, look after these cops. And I just, like, I was just eating it up. And after rereading it, I'm just like, oh, did I not, like, get this the first time? But, like, it's amazing. Like, it's a work of art.
Yeah, no, I always wondered why you didn't like it so much, because it's one of mine, too. And you really liked Hush, which was written by Jeff Loeb, too, and it's...
Yeah, and I was wrong. I admit when I'm wrong.
No, it's okay. You should go back and reread Dark Victory now, because that's just...
See, I've never read Dark Victory. I didn't read it after a long Halloween, so I'm going to go read that. I'm going to pick it up probably in a couple weeks.
Oh, yeah, Dark Victory's excellent. But also, now that you've read Long Halloween and liked it, how excited are you for Dark Knight now?
Oh, like, well, I mean, and that's, I have to give you credit, because you gave me Face to Face, and then I picked up Long Halloween. I don't think I could be any more prepared for The Dark Knight than this. And then also, in the Absolute Edition, the foreword is by Christopher Nolan and David Goyer, and basically they're just talking about, like, how The Long Halloween is the basis for the first two Batman movies, and, like, just right there, like, I'm just getting pumped, like, I'm getting so excited, you know? And right when you know, the first page is, you know, Bruce saying, I believe in Harvey Dent. And I'm just like, oh, I already see talking about how he believes in Gotham City, he believes in Harvey Dent and everything. And I at that point, I was just like, I was so ready. You know, like, I cannot wait for this movie. It's going to be, like, amazing. Reading this book, like, if anyone out there has The Long Halloween, read it before you go see Dark Knight. If you haven't read it, go kind of do your history before you see the movie, because it's going to make a lot of difference, I think.
Yeah. Well,
so are you happy with me, Eric? That's three big Batman books that I read in the last couple of weeks.
I can't believe it. I'm just beside myself here. Like, I'm in Bizarro World right now.
You owe me some hardcore X-Men stuff that you have to read.
Crazy. Hey, I try with X-Men. I'm into Spider-Man. I'm into X-Men now. I'm reading Astonishing.
That's true.
But
that's true.
No, I'm very pleased to hear all this. This is wonderful stuff. So, if you have any comments on The Dark Knight or Killing Joke or anything else at all, you can email us at contact@fanboystrikeback.com, and we always love to hear questions and comments about the show. If you write in, you know, of course we'll read your questions on the show and answer them. You can also go to our website at www.fanboystrikeback.com, and that's where we post our written review of the book that we pick each week, as well as links to our forums, and there's where we have topics set up that we discuss that we don't talk about on the show, so anything that you're wondering about our opinions on that we don't discuss, you can always go there. We are also on iTunes.
Yep, iTunes, Podcast Alley, any podcaster out there. If you do like our show, please leave us a review. Right now, you know, we have some pretty positive reviews. We only have 6, though. And I think 10 sounds like a nice round number. So if we, let's make that for the goal right now. So we need 4 more reviews. We know you guys are out there listening. And if you could just take a couple minutes for a quick review, that would really help us out a lot. Makes us more noticeable when people search for podcasts. So, like Eric said, head over to the forum, to the website, you know, shoot us an email, let us know what you thought about Indiana Jones, if you guys have read Long Halloween, what's the favorite Batman story, anything. We want to hear your guys' thoughts on everything. We thank you so much for listening and for the reviews. We appreciate it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it for this week, you know, so I am David.
I'm Eric.
See you next week.